Hey, it's Duff Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our listeners in 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Christine Amor-Lavar, the founder of two award-winning NGOs, Her Planet Earth and Women on a Mission. Christine is also a human rights and sustainability advisor, a climate investor, a best-selling Penguin author of the book Wild Wisdom, a TEDx speaker, board member, and advisor to several purpose-led organizations. Christine's career started strong in Japan at McCann Erickson and Philip Stark before moving to Nike in New York and around Asia. She then went on to lead marketing and communications at Temasek Trust, the philanthropic arm of Singapore's sovereign wealth fund, Temasek Holdings. In this episode, we talk about her wild expeditions around the world raising funds for charity, being a purpose-driven leader, positivity as a muscle, what success really means, and so much more. I hope you enjoy this smooth conversation thanks to our sound partner, Audio Technica. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Okay, well, Christine, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I'm very excited for this conversation and to just, learn a little bit more about you as well. So I'd love for us to start maybe in your early life of what Christine was like, what those early years were like, and how your journey has brought you to where you are now.
Thank you so much, Steph, first for having me on the podcast. I'm really honored to be here and very happy to have this conversation with you. So early Christine, childhood Christine, I was very lucky to have a happy childhood. I was born and raised in the Philippines. So my earliest memories is really of my parents being very happy together. I was the first born in a warm, sunny place in Manila where I was born when they were living in a little house that had a beautiful garden. So as I wrote in my book, these are some of the earliest memories and they're very happy memories. And I'm very grateful to have those happy memories because I think at the end of the day, those were the foundation. That's the foundation of my life, you know, and I was blessed to have a good start in life. There was a lot of love in our home. And it was also a multiracial, multicultural and multilingual home. So a lot going on in our family. But yes, very happy memories. Growing up in the Philippines, so the first 18 years of my life, 13 of those were spent in Manila. And in the middle of those, you know, years, those 18 years, I spent 5 years in France. So 0 to 5 in the Philippines and then 5 to 10 in France in a small town outside of Paris near Chantilly, Château de Chantilly. It's a beautiful area where we were able to ride ponies and be near a forest. It was really a beautiful place. And then came back to the Philippines. So what took my family to France was an opportunity for work for my dad. And then actually that didn't really work out for him. And then we went back to the Philippines altogether. And my little brother was born in France and my sister and I were very close in age. So she was born in the Philippines too. So back in the Philippines and then graduated from high school, from the international school, did the Ivy diploma, went to Japan for university, spent 6 years in Japan. So I did all my undergraduate at the Japanese university called Sophia University in Tokyo. And then my first job was with an American advertising agency called McCann Erickson. And actually one of the clients of McCann was Nike in Tokyo and they were growing their business exponentially at the time. And I was lucky enough to, through different introductions, to meet one of the heads of Nike there. And I ended up with a job in the U.S. at their world headquarters in Oregon. So my first time to live in the U.S., such a contrast to living in Japan and anything I had known. But, you know, at the world headquarters of a really exciting company. So that was kind of a dream come true for me because growing up, I love playing sports. And Nike was really one of my favorite brands. So it was really, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was driving to work in my little red Jeep and I used to pinch myself all the time. And I work with an amazing group of people and I'm still in touch with many of them all these years. And so that was really good. So I started working on their Japan business and then there were opportunities for me to work in their Americas region, which included Canada and Latin America. And I ended up being one of their youngest PR managers for the regions at 23. They promoted me. My boss believed in me. I actually think that the shoes were quite big to fill for me in a role like that, but they believed in me and gave me that opportunity early on. And then I moved to Europe with them during the World Cup, worked in the French office, worked regionally with their team in Holland, and then ended up moving to Singapore many years later. And that's how I got to Singapore. So that was 17 years ago, arrived and ran the marketing here for Nike. And to be very honest, the experience was not as exciting as being in a big office, like at the regional or even global headquarters. So, and there was a lot of things happening in parallel with my life as well. So I made a change of career. And so the last 10 years, I've really been focused on philanthropy. I set up a couple of nonprofits supporting women. The first one is called Women on a Mission that supports supports women impacted by violence and abuse. And the other one is called Her Planet Earth, that supports women impacted by climate change. And we do this by taking women on expeditions around the world as a way to raise funds for our charity partners. So that's really been kind of, you know, the culmination of a lot of passion for sports and wanting to find a way to contribute. And I've been really happy that this has happened in my life. And the other day, somebody asked me, what are you the most proud of? And I would say this is probably the most proud of. It's a volunteer movement. Whatever we fundraise, we donate. But it's brought me so much joy and happiness, and also has brought along many other opportunities for me to set up my consultancy business. So I've operated for the last 9 years as an independent consultant, first taking on one of the big clients in Singapore, Temasek Trust, and then after that, taking on more clients in the startup ecosystem and eventually leading into impact investing. So this is where I find myself today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing. What was the precipice for you to want to start Women on a Mission and then Her Planet Earth? Like, there must have been a few things that led you to decide to leave that corporate world and climbing that corporate ladder and go into the philanthropy in the first place.
Yeah. So, you know, even though I was very happy with my role at Nike, I really do believe that there was something missing in my life, that maybe more of a sense of purpose. And so that tipping point, if you will, that change in my career path or my life even, happened when I met a lady who became my co-founder at Women on a Mission. Her name is Valérie Beaufy. And I always credit her with, you know, meeting her really could change the course of my life. She was about to climb Everest and she did it in support of a charity called Women for Women International that she had been volunteering for many years before when she used to live in London. And at the top of Everest, she had this banner that said, bearing the flags for women everywhere. And that really impacted me. It kind of woke me up. It was really something that that kind of opened my eyes to the fact that this is something that inspires me. And it showed courage and resilience on her part. And it was really, you know, going to the summit of the world to raise a flag for women who are some of the most marginalized in the world. You know, women survivors of war, are women who are in conflict zones, are often more affected than even soldiers. You know, they lose everything, they get raped, they get abused. And so it really touched me. It really, you know, I had a great sense of empathy for the cause. And I knew that I needed to support this initiative and I wanted to do it with her. And so together we set up Women on a Mission, rallied some friends for our first trek and set out to raise $100,000 for this charity. And given the fact that I had a marketing background, I really wanted to put more focus on the reason we were doing this and try to raise awareness about this issue. And so started writing a press release that said Women on a Mission to Reach Higher Ground, and the name stuck. My sister designed our first logo, and we basically ended up raising about $150,000 with this expedition and two events, one before the trek and one after. And basically, this is how Women on a Mission was born. And we started getting lots of women writing to us and calling us and saying, when's the next trek? I want to join. This is amazing, you know? So it's been, it's been 10 years, over 10 years now, 11 expeditions with Women on a Mission, over $1 million US raised, and still going strong. So that's been amazing. And it also led me to set up my second NGO, Her Planet Earth, 5 years later. A sister NGO, if you will, similar in the sense that we also bring women on expedition, but the focus is really around supporting charities that help women who are impacted by climate change become more resilient.
It's so incredible. And I can't wait to eventually actually join you on one of these adventures. How do you even decide or like find all these wild adventures? And maybe you can sort of share a few of like exactly what they've looked like for people, like color it in.
Sure, of course. So, you know, I have a bucket list of places I want to go, and my teammates and partners often do as well. So we are constantly brainstorming for ideas and, oh, wouldn't it be nice to go to Tibet? Or wouldn't it be nice to go to Antarctica? And eventually I keep ticking off those bucket lists. And so that's kind of where we start. You know, together we kind of think about a place we'd love to go, and then we curate, you know, a cause. Obviously for Women in the Missions, it's always supporting women impacted by violence and abuse. So our charity partners have been long-term partners, and we do want to be sustainable and continue to support them over the years. And same with Her Planet Earth, much more of NGOs focused on environmental and conservation issues. We start with a location. We think, what a great challenge that would be. Let's find out if a group of women has done the summit or has ever crossed this, you know, Greenland, Arctic Circle trail on fat bikes, and oh, nobody's done it before. So things like that. So it starts with a lot of kind of being creative and also doing research around areas we want to go. Then we, of course, we talk to our charity partners and we kind of customize together. Let's say we're going going to raise $50,000 or $100,000, we really work with them to see, okay, well, for Her Planet Earth, I'd really like to support an agricultural program in Asia because I know women are most impacted in this space in Asia. What do you have? What's really concrete? So we study those things together. It takes quite a bit of time. And then I curate the whole thing, write a press release. I usually start with a press release because I want to crystallize the message and the reason we're doing it. And then I set up a deck. I prepare a deck. And then we start the recruitment of the teammates. Once the cause is very clear and the challenge is very clear and the tour operator is selected and the price is set, because obviously these teammates are self-funded. And so and if you do those decks well and the message is clear, the recruitment is very easy actually, because it's like, okay, this is exciting and what a great cause, you know? So over the years, I've gotten better at it. And so even this last couple of months, I think I mentioned to you, Steph, that my recruitment went so fast because I'm doing better, you know, I'm getting better at these, at crystallizing what we're really trying to do here. So it's taking a few years to get there. And I'm still learning every day.
And what were some of the most challenging expeditions or moments that really shifted something for you?
Well, the first one was really spectacular. I mean, a trek to Everest Base Camp is not an easy trek. You're going up to 5,400 meters. So there's a lot of people really felt the altitude. I felt it, you know. A couple of the teammates even needed oxygen at one of the last camps. And altitude sickness is quite a serious issue that you can't ignore. And that was transformational, I think, for me and for all my teammates, because it was tough. It was 14 days on the road. I remember we collectively as a team lost over 20 kilos. Because, you know, you're at altitude, you're burning much more. You're trekking every day, 8 hours a day. You know, maybe you're not eating exactly or sleeping as well. That one was really quite something. And it also showed me, you know, what I was capable of in terms of that resilience. And it motivated me to do more. So I think that one was really one of the most important. And then over the years, we've had, you know, I've basically organized over 20 expeditions now. And some were very tough. I would say the two toughest ones were one with Women on a Mission in Ethiopia in the Danakil Depression, which is the hottest place on earth. And we took bikes because nobody had done bikes before across that desert. And we actually suffered heat stroke, which is also very serious and a very humbling experience for me as a team leader. And I'm glad nobody, you know, we didn't lose anyone, but, you know, there were a lot of people that were a bit not feeling well, including myself. And then Greenland was very tough, a beautiful experience with Her Planet Earth, 200 kilometers on fat bikes across the Arctic Circle Trail in winter, you know, just the coldest experience. It went down to minus 40 degrees on one day. And you couldn't really stop because it's too cold to stop. So you stop, you put on another big jacket on, and then you might get a bit of a cup of tea from the support crew. So we had one vehicle that was following us in case of emergency. And then you have to go again. So you're out there for 10 hours and you arrive completely destroyed and just exhausted. And I remember that after the week's crossing that we did, we finally took a shower, because you don't take a shower, you're camping in like these tiny huts along the way. And our legs were full of bruises, you know, I'd never had legs like this, black and blue all over. And it was just good to get back to civilization. I would say those were the toughest ones. And, you know, when you get pushed physically, mentally, emotionally to the limits, it is transformational for all of us, you know. You learn more about yourself. You have a deeper respect for nature, for the beauty and the magnitude of nature. You know, you're really a speck in all of it, and you're really powerless in many ways. So it's very humbling, which is always good, right? It brings you back down to earth and just lets you respect and appreciate nature so much. And also the team spirit. You're really looking after each other like sisters. You really do, because it's also a bit about survival, even though it's not, you know, 3-4 months, but it is an intense couple of weeks. So yeah, those experiences are life-changing, I would say. And we try to craft the expeditions that way.
Yeah. And was there ever a moment where you were like, oh, I don't think I can do this anymore on any of these trips, and that you wanted to get out?
There were definitely a few. The thing is, you can't really get out. You're in the middle of nowhere, right? Generally. I remember one time when I was back in Nepal with a team, the Tsum Valley, we did the old Silk Road up to Tibet on the border of China. We didn't cross over it. We're still in Nepal. And it was just one of those days that, first of all, we had been trekking for a few days. There wasn't much food in this part of Nepal because it was only open to tourists in the late 2000s, 2008, 2009. And so we were not eating as well. We weren't sleeping well. And that day we had walked for 10 hours and we had been crossing a river. So we had to go down, cross the river, go up again, up and down. And we had an elevation gain of over 1,000 meters in one day, which is a lot, you know, going down 500 meters, going up again. So everybody was exhausted. And I remember being so exhausted. exhausted when we finally arrived at our little camp that I didn't even have the strength to open my bag, and I burst into tears, you know, from pure exhaustion and just being sore everywhere, and just it never ended. It was the day that never ended, you know, and it was like, I want to stop already, but you're not just going to stop in the middle of the road, right? So yeah, so there are moments where you think, wow, you know, I consider myself pretty fit, although I have teammates that are much more fit than me. I've had Iron Women, you know, and I've had first-time trekkers, so we have a big range. But yeah, there are moments where you really feel that the tank is empty. That's exactly how I felt many times, especially when you go at higher altitude, and that you're living on fumes, you know, like you're forcing yourself to eat little energy bars just to get the fuel in so that you can keep going, because, you know, I'm not a very big woman. And so even when you're trekking like that, you're not eating so well, you quickly are running out of fuel, you know, sometimes. So yeah, so it's been exhausting many times.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, all the different places you've been and just how much you've achieved, I guess, in these 11 years. And, you know, I think I read that you've raised over $1.7 million for the charities combined, and both for the environment and the advancement of women and protection. So what kind of impact has this made? Have you had any stories, or like, I'm sure that keeps you going in the hard times as well.
Sure. So obviously with Women on a Mission, we've been supporting for over 10 years now, women survivors of war. So our funds have actually impacted about 500 women, specifically through the programs of Women for Women International. It's an education program that takes a woman from one of those communities, you know, conflict zones. They're actually selected by their own other women in the community who say, we need to support this person because she's a widow and she needs help. And, you know, there are some quantifiable definitely impact, you know, so we've got, you know, through one charity, we've supported about 500 women survivors of war. Through another, you know, we've supported 50 women, you know, in different parts, like in Iran as well. We worked through a program with one of the local charities. So we have that. And we also have a big sister program in Singapore that's been going for over 5 years with Pertapis Home. So it's a small grassroots initiative, but it's been going over 5 years. And we've actually formed about 50 big sisters to pair up with little sisters. So these are little initiatives. Obviously, they add up over the years. And that's been really amazing to see that grow. With Her Planet Earth, the focus, is, as I said, is much more around the environment. So our funds, for example, with Conservation International as a partner in Kenya, has funded jobs for women in elephant sanctuaries, or even to train women as rangers, because a lot of times it's traditionally a role that men have. So we've been kind of monitoring that through our charity partners. Same with UN Women. So we work with UN Women across Vietnam, Bangladesh, Nepal, Cambodia as well, and for our next expedition to Sri Lanka. And so the specific programs, you know, that we raise funds for have impacted over 300 women in agricultural zone, where we help them grow crops that are more suited for the soil in their region. So we do try to keep track of all that. And we have very long-term relationships with our charity partners. Many of those charity partners I also sit on the board of. So Zero Waste SG is one of my Her Planet Earth partners. I'm also on the board, and same with Women for Women International. I'm on their advisory board. So in a way, we try to stay really close to what they're doing so that we have full reports on the funds that we raise. So every expedition, there is a report that is generated that we share with the teammates and with the donors. So as much as we can, we really try to stay close to how the funds are used and how it is executed. And over the years, I've learned a lot, because sometimes, you know, I would choose a grassroots charity, let's say in the Philippines, and they seemed, you know, perfect, and they would execute really well. And I realized they weren't able to execute so well. So over the years, you learn that sometimes you also need to go with well-established and slightly bigger charities that then have done the vetting to work with smaller charities in other countries. And that, for me, has worked much better, even though some people will say, oh, you know, there's a certain amount goes to salaries of people who work in nonprofits. But I think that's completely fair, and they should be well rewarded so that they can stay long-term in those jobs, because we need continuity too for the staff to run those programs. So over the years, I really learned how they also run those organizations and you know, how are they more effective. And oftentimes we, you know, we are really hands-on with them in terms of how they allocate and execute on the funds we raised.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And I love that they're long-term partners, because I think then you can really build a relationship with them and make more impact. So obviously you take teams of up to 16 women, I think I understand, on these different treks and expeditions around the world. So you have to be a leader and be the team leader for that, and also a leader in lots of different other aspects of everything that keeps you busy. So what does that mean to you?
Oh, it means everything. You know, the women that I've met along the journey, taking women on expeditions with me has meant everything because I've, as a result, I've really developed a tribe of incredible women. The women we take with us are very unique. You know, they're women who, first of all, you know, are really wanting to give back in some way and not just go to a gala and make a donation. They actually want to put themselves out far outside their comfort zone. And sometimes it's also scary for them and being away from their families and also asking for money as we fundraise because everybody has to fundraise for a team target. I never put a limit, but we have a team target. So the women, you know, that I've met all these years are really, they've really blown me away in many ways. You know, they're 22 to 60 year olds from all industries and professions. They're brave and they're resilient and they have big hearts and they're courageous. So for me, that's been one of the huge highlights of creating these movements is the women that I've been able to take along with me on the journey and gotten to know as sisters because we're really bonded. You know, when you go through especially an expedition that really pushes you a little bit to the limit in many cases, you develop this relationship that through thick and thin, you'll always be there for each other. And even if it's been a few years, and that's why I have so many repeat teammates, actually. I think it's because they really crave that sisterhood and wanting to challenge themselves again. And they bring along their friends and recommend their sisters. Yeah. So the women are spectacular women. I have so much love and respect for them.
Yeah. Incredible. And how do you think you find what you were meant to do? Like, did it come all at once for you when you were first figuring out what you think your calling and your purpose was, or did it evolve over time?
I think for me, it evolved over time. The seed was planted for sure when I was a child because I was a very sensitive child. So I had a lot of empathy when I saw suffering and I saw poverty in the Philippines. And so I remember early on that, you know, it did bother me. I was affected. I would ask my parents, how come I have a roof and I have food and I have a good school and many other kids around me don't have? Because in the Philippines, it's very obvious. So you really see it. And also when climate used to swing violently in the Philippines, there were so many reports and pictures in the news or in TV of poor families, you know, suffering and dying because of the massive storms that we have. The Philippines is one of the countries most affected by climate change. So for sure, that sensitivity was there early on. Of course, I didn't know how to help. You know, you can come along with your family and do a few charitable activities, but what can you do? And so my passion was also sports. So at an early age, for me, the motivation was to find a job in sports. I wanted to leave the Philippines and experience the world and travel far and wide and ideally get a job related to sports. So that was my early motivation. And it's only much later in my life, maybe when I became a mother as well, which often also brings back a lot of feelings and also values come back, I think, and you really evaluate what you want to do with your life and what you want to do in terms of being an example to your children too. But it wasn't so much a conscious decision. So it was an opportunity that put me, you know, in the line of seeing Valérie do her climb. And I honestly feel that maybe I was waiting to be tapped figuratively on the shoulder and say, this is where you can put your talent and your energy and your love for sports because our two nonprofits have sports and adventure at the very core. So it was almost like it was tailored for me, I feel. I really believe in destiny a little bit and sometimes opportunities coming your way because you're meant to see them and meant to grab them. So that's how I feel. It's like it was meant to be and I was ready for it. And it came at the perfect time in my life. And I have the skills suited to do it and I enjoy it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it for over 10 years now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you have four kids and you're running two NGOs, you're a board member, advisor to multiple purpose-led organizations, and you wrote a best-selling book. So you're juggling a lot and you appear to do it with such ease and grace and with an abundance of energy, which I've always admired about you. But yeah, what are your secrets and tools that you use to kind of stay on top of it all and stay focused and motivated? Because life can be hard sometimes.
Yes. So there's a lot going on, that's for sure. Although I have to say that the projects and initiatives that I pick, I really enjoy. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. You know, so there is a part of me that's also, I love to enjoy life. I think you can see, you know me, Steph. So I'm a bon vivant, you know, and honestly, if I don't enjoy something, I will find a way to not do it or to get out of it, you know? So there's that, but there is a lot and I am juggling a lot. I have a couple of project managers now helping me through my consultancy business because I do have quite a few projects on and need their support and they're amazing actually. But I am very organized. So it's not like it's, you know, It just happens and it's easy. So there's a lot of thinking and a process behind it, you know, which I've been doing actually for about 20 years. So 20 years ago, I used to, when December came along, I used to assess the year and look at the year ahead. And I started handwriting what were my goals and objectives. What do I really want to focus on? And over the years, I kept doing it and I kept rewriting it. And after a while, I digitalized it because it took so long, right, to rewrite the whole thing. And so now I've actually really got a process which I rely on, I have to say. So basically, at the end of the year, the first thing I do is I look back on the year and I list everything that I'm grateful for. And those can be milestones too. You know, I'll go through my social media and see some of the things that I posted and I'll say, oh, that was amazing. That was really cool. I really enjoyed that. A holiday here, an interview I did, or, you know, something that happened, an award maybe that I got. So I list that and I'm really grateful about those things. And I think that's really important to take stock and to also tap yourself on the shoulder and say, hey, it's been a good year. Come on. Not everything was perfect, but you've done well, you know, you've worked hard. And so I start with that. I start that as a base. And then I look at the following year and I really think hard, what are the three things that I want to focus on? So I start with three big ideas or three big things that can be the theme of the year, right? But then I go into much more detail. I look at different aspects of my life, like from spirituality and fitness and finances and love and family and growth and career. So I actually go into much more detail. And actually I do it and I list it and I put images to inspire me and pictures and visuals and icons, multicolored. And then I break it down into 12 months and I actually list things that are happening, or there's an event in January, you know, there's a family holiday here. So it's all like, it's like my life, my personal and my career definitely come together, because life is like that, right? In a way we try to separate it, but the truth is we are living life, and oftentimes they kind of, everything kind of comes in and meshes together, right? And so I do that, and I put a lot of detail around that and very concrete. And I also have a page that I call Big Ass Dreams. They're a bit more like more moonshots that you might be a bit shy to write it down, but you say, hey, why not? You know, I'll put that. These are secretly what I hope that I can achieve. And if it happens, amazing. And if it doesn't happen, maybe I'll try again the following year. So it's kind of like listing your wish list of things, but actually being a little bit more organized and how you list it. And I bring it out every Sunday without fail. And I look at it because I end up printing it. I print it once a year, so I don't waste too much paper, on an A5 size kind of page. And I put it in a leather bound folder that I have, a red one for energy. And I read it every Sunday and I look at my calendar and I look at all the appointments I have. And honestly, if something doesn't really align, sometimes I'll just cancel that appointment because we have such limited times. And I also then try to see, you know, if what I'm doing that week kind of aligns with the plan or the areas of focus that I really wanted to focus on. Because otherwise, as you know, we can go through months after months just running around, going from meeting to meeting, and then going like, well, this is not exactly what I wanted to focus on, right? So I try to align that. So it's a bit of a process, and I'm quite intentional and very kind of focused when I do this, because I feel that that's the way that I feel that I'm not randomly going through my schedule. I want to have purpose. I want to have focus, and that allows me to be a bit more organized. And sometimes I don't do everything, and that's okay. But I also try to revisit it. So I might move it down the list. And yeah, so there's a bit of a process, and it's worked well for me to try to do what I need to do and what I want to do and what I enjoy doing.
Yeah, no, I love the fact that there is the reflection, but also the consistency of looking at it every week, because
it's a habit.
Yes, exactly. And the more that we can flex those muscles, then the easier it becomes. And you probably even look forward to it every Sunday.
So yeah. It never stresses me when I do this. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy pulling out my little red book and I go through it and I scribble at it sometimes, make changes, you know, because I only print it once a year, right? So I update a whole bunch of things on it as I go along every month, every week. Yeah, and actually I enjoy looking at it. It's not stressful at all. On the contrary, it's like, oh, this is so great. Oh, I love this icon that I put. Yeah. So the visuals are really important to keep it light, but still focused and powerful. And I also have a section at the end with all the quotes that I love, that inspire me, you know. And actually, when I was reading my book, I was like looking through some of the quotes and say, oh, maybe this would work well for this chapter because I love this quote. I've had it in this book forever. So yeah, so I try to live by that and keep it very close to me.
Yeah. And it's not unmanageable because it's just once a week.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think nowadays people want to be good parents. They want to have a good career. They want to enjoy their lives. And I think, yeah, it can be challenging. You know, as you know, I'm pregnant and going through all of this in my head at the moment as well. So do you think that anyone really can have it all, male or female? Or do you think that there are always sacrifices somewhere and that, you know, we have to kind of just learn that you can't really have everything, but you can have a little bit of the things that really matter? I don't know.
Yeah. It's funny because I never think about myself with that that idea, like having everything. It's more about having what you enjoy or having what you want to do. So I suppose maybe from the outside, if somebody said, okay, well, you're happily married, you have kids, you know, maybe that seems like you have it all. But I think it's really case by case for people, and life is not also what it seems from the outside, you know. So I try not to focus too much on that. It's much more about, it's an individual thing, right? So every person has to decide what they want, and having it all for one person is certainly not what another person might think. Somebody might not believe in marriage or having children, and that's absolutely okay, right? So for me, I'm just thinking, you know, I think we have a duty, all of us, to be as happy as we can in this world and try to leave it in a better place, in a better way. So I think that's kind of the big brush strokes for me. And how you lead your life and how you end up forging relationships and walking through the journey of life is really your choice. And it's very individual. And there's no rule. There's no one size fits all. So for me, that question is not something that I really think too much about. I just am focused on what I want to do and what makes me feel good. And I feel like I'm contributing. I think that's really important. I think most human beings have this desire deep inside to be meaningful, to be good, to find meaning in life. You know, I think that's intrinsic in so many of us. And, you know, we need difference. We need all sorts in the world, right? So it's not really, it doesn't matter if you have it all or not. It's actually limiting to think like that, I feel, you know. It's, are you living the life that you want? Are you happy that way? Are you helping other people be happier and more successful, and also, you know, having a positive kind of footprint on the journey of life as you go along?
Mm. And did you always have that positivity as a person, or is it a skill and habit that you've also had to, you know, really work on?
I worked on it, I have to say. So, you know, when you're a kid, you grow up and you're just taking it all in, you're influenced so much by your family, right? If your parents are having a bad day, it also affects you. And then generally I was an extrovert. So I love sports. I was an extrovert. I was generally a happy, you know, personality. Like every teenager, I went through ups and downs, a bit moody and didn't get along with my mom sometimes. And then I remember my mom put me through a course, because my aunt was running something like that in the Philippines. And it came when I was about 17 years old, and it really impacted me. It was kind of like a Tony Robbins type course. It wasn't Tony Robbins, but it was something similar. And she said, oh, this summer you're not busy. Why don't you join your aunt's program? And so I actually took a lot in. And one of the biggest lessons I took was, when you have problems in life or when you look at obstacles, you can focus so hard on obstacles that you don't know what to do. The key is, of course, to look beyond the obstacle and look at solutions and where you want to go, because then you will find the solutions more easily. And so I remember taking notes, and this is one of the biggest things that helped me. So that helped me become a little bit more proactive and positive. And then later on at university, my first boyfriend, actually, who's an American guy, who's a lovely guy called Jesse Stein. We're still very good friends. He's happily married, living in the US. He was somebody who was very positive, and I learned a lot from him, I have to say, about being more positive and also incorporating workouts more, you know, in my life, and not just because I wasn't able to play sports team as much. So I was, he taught me how to use the gym more and just be a much more positive person. So I think the positivity I've honed over the years. I think by nature, I'm a happy person, but I like everyone, we can be influenced and we can have days where we're a bit down and depressed. And so I do believe it's a bit like a muscle, that positivity and that positive outlook, because you can train yourself to look at a situation in a more positive way. And I think I've tried to do that over the years, and that's kind of become a habit again, right? So it becomes a habit, and then that's your default a little bit when things happen or through life. You try to keep it light and happy and positive, and then you find solutions more easily, and then you end up being happier, right? So it's a vicious cycle in that sense. So I would say I worked on it too, but I had a good foundation as a generally happy person.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is important to remember that it takes time sometimes to rewire our brains and, to build that foundation. So tell us about Wild Wisdom, your best-selling book, and how it came about and what you hope that readers take away from it.
Yes. So Wild Wisdom happened, I think, by chance a little bit, because I had wanted to write a second book. So it's my second book. The first book was self-published. It's called, I have to give you a copy today, The Smart Girl's Handbook to Being Mommylicious. I wrote this book about post-pregnancy diet and fitness and not losing your groove when you become a mom, because I found it hard as well to get my life back in order every time I had a baby. So I always said I would write another book, and I would definitely write about the expeditions and my lessons from that. And I had this little folder in my desktop. And when the pandemic happened, and obviously everybody was stuck at home, I thought, I'm going to work on this. And so I started looking at all the stories that I had written over the years, because over the years I'd always written a little essay about each expedition, tried to have it published somewhere. So I did have some material of all these expeditions, and I started writing a bit more of my memoir. So the first few years, my childhood, my values, all that. And so eventually I got contacted by Penguin just by chance on LinkedIn. And long story short, but basically they offered me a book contract when I was not even looking for a publisher, which was really perfect for me. And they helped me actually shape the book and said, really put your emphasis on your expeditions, put one expedition per chapter, bring out the life lessons much more. And whatever you wrote in your memoir, condense it in a couple chapters. That's good enough. You're not Michelle Obama anyway. So I did that and I really enjoyed it. It was hard work. You know, I needed more hours, so I would get up, you know, at 5 a.m. to write. And it took a lot of time because writing takes time. I'm sure you know. I mean, in the edits, you know, that first edit that came back was, there was so much work. I had so much work to try to improve it, to try to have that thread through it. And some of the editors really helped me. Wild Wisdom was a title that somebody had suggested to me when I did a keynote at MBS pre-pandemic, because I was talking about leadership lessons from leading teams, and it was through a corporate group. So I kept coming back to that title. I actually listed like 15 other titles. I used to ask friends and family, and then I kept coming back to Wild Wisdom because it was so perfect for it, you know, the wisdom of the wild. And so slowly the book came together, and I'm so glad it's over and it's out. And it's been really special sharing it with other people and sharing my journey. And even my kids have read it and were like, oh, mom, I didn't know about this, or, you know. So it's been a wonderful journey. And I'm still, you know, I have a book launch again tomorrow night, and I have a series of them coming up. And every time, it's special to share those stories with people, and I hope they enjoy the book. And ultimately, my hope is that people can see that a regular woman, I'm just an ordinary woman, okay? But in my life, I've had the opportunities to do some pretty extraordinary things. And so if I can do that, I hope it motivates people to just go for it, go after their dreams fearlessly without limitations, and just keep working hard at it, because it's not come just by luck, right? There's so much hard work, as you know yourself with your, you know, how you build your business. You know, people don't see a lot of the blood, sweat and tears behind it, right? It's definitely not a magic wand. And so I hope that inspires them.
Yeah, fantastic. And at the end of the book, there's a lovely story about the wolves, which I've heard before actually, but I would love for you to share it again here.
Yeah, I love that story too. And I really wanted to put it because I thought it went really well with the title of Wild Wisdom. And you know, we talk about this Cherokee tale of the wolf, you feed the wolf. But there's beyond that story is the dark wolf as well, you know? And so, you know, me being a positive person, I'm also aware of that, because I always try to feed, you know, the light wolf, right? So be happy and all that. But the dark wolf has a lot to teach us. And I wanted to address that, because our fears, our trauma, our insecurities, we need a self-awareness. And I do believe that one of the beautiful gifts that traveling so much in remote places has given me more self-awareness of my strength and weaknesses and the issues that I have, or the fears I have. And so feeding both wolves is really important, to be aware of your strengths and your weaknesses and your fears, and acknowledging them and respecting them, because if we suppress them, as you know, they will always come out some way. And so I thought it was important to mention that, because for me, I learned a lot from that, and I'm aware of that, and I'm still working on trying to make sure I feed both wolves well and equally.
Yeah, I think because it's the light and the darkness is something I've battled with for a long time, but having that extra understanding of the story that you don't ignore one of the wolves, because then it kind of acts out and then it can cause even more havoc, you actually need to feed both sides.
Feed and acknowledge. And give them that respect, you know?
Yeah. And I think that was really eye-opening. And just, I love these kind of analogies that just help you to understand it, to be like, oh, it's so true. Like, we can't have the light without the dark. And you just need to learn how to manage both sides and not get completely lost in one of them.
And the dark is also a power and a strength, you know? I mean, if you go back and let's say you acknowledge that you've had some sort of childhood trauma, and many of us have, you know, it can have happened innocently, the way maybe you were brought up or your parents reacted to something that you did. And I think acknowledging it and reflecting on it and realizing you have this sensitivity, you have this little chip, it's also what makes you so beautiful and strong. That vulnerability is precious to bring at the core of your life and give it that respect, you know? So yeah, and that's also part of becoming wiser, right? And that's part of the wild wisdom, right? In the book. So I'm still learning to deal with that as well.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's a lifelong journey. I don't think it's something that we're definitely ever really going to completely master. And so how do you think we can avoid sleepwalking through life and instead live wide awake?
Yes. So part of it is having some practical tools, like what I mentioned. So I think for me, that has helped me not sleepwalk through my schedule because we end up being very busy and the rat race, et cetera, right? So having a purpose at the core of your life and making sure it aligns with what you said you wanted to put your time and energy on is really important. And having some tools where you have reminders or, you know, and it's a simple thing and yet we often don't think about it, right? So I think that's one. And of course, the big one is action, right? So you can have a list and you can talk about it, but what are you doing concretely? Because it's only when you do it concretely that you get that fulfillment and you are actually moving things in the right direction. So action is very important. And so that can relate to climate action. We can all find our own way of supporting the climate movement, right? Because not everybody has to do it the same way. It can be around female empowerment, whatever your passion is, it's about protecting animals. How are you concretely? So for me, that allows you to be more awake and more aware and using your skills, because we all have gifts and skills, right? And it doesn't mean that you have to do exactly what somebody else is doing. It doesn't mean you have to quit your job. It doesn't mean you have to start a nonprofit. I think you're finding your own unique way of contributing, but actually putting real action, even if it's like raising funds or writing a story about it, talking to people, being an advocate. There's so many ways to do that. And then you will be living wide awake, I feel, because you will be contributing in your very unique way, your own brand of contribution, which is always more powerful when it's authentic to you, right? And then you will be more connected with and aligned with your values, you know, and so that allows you to be self-aware, more awake, more in touch with your community and with your own inner strength as well.
Absolutely. Well, Christine, thank you so much for sharing with us and all your vulnerability and your crazy adventures. It's really beautiful.
So thank you so much, Stephanie, for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation as always.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Christine. Firstly, we have a duty to be as happy as we can in this world and to try to leave it in a better way. So how can we lead our lives and how can we walk through this journey knowing that life is a choice and it's very individual? There's no one size fits all. Secondly, it's limiting to think about having it all. Instead, are we living the life that we want? Are we happy? Are we helping other people to be happier and successful? Thirdly, it's important to feed both wolves, as if we suppress one, then it acts out. So we have to feed and acknowledge both sides. We can't have the light without the dark, and the dark is a power and a strength. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode, and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steffel Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.